Next, we'll be talking about gallbladder and biliary tract issues from Peter Kingham from Memorial Sloan Kettering.
Thank you. It's great to be here. This was a challenging talk to put together because I've actually never done a literature search on this topic, and there really are not much data out there. So I'm going to discuss some themes and anecdotes, and I mentioned some cases here, and I know there's a lot of cases later on that I think we'll get into the complexities of these situations. I don't have any disclosures. I'm going to talk about cholecystitis and then cholangitis and biliary obstruction. So the initial questions are things that Bridget went over about cancer diagnosis, stage, and prognosis. And I think you can't stress enough about the stage of cancer a patient has, their quality, current quality of life, goal of their quality of life, and where they stand in their cancer treatment, which is a discussion with the medical oncologist. And often it's the outpatient medical oncologist that you have to track down to find out what's really happening on with this patient in the big picture. So for cholecystitis, there's a couple different themes for common referrals. So one would be a breast cancer patient with right upper quadrant pain and elevated white count. Another would be a bone marrow transplant patient with neutropenia for 3 weeks and now with right upper quadrant pain. Another would be metastatic duodenal cancer who had a covered common bile duct stent placed and now has cholecystitis. So when considering patients with cholecystitis who also have a cancer, there are a couple unique aspects to this. So one is, you know, operating on patients with advanced peritoneal disease can be very challenging. If patients have ascites, they'll have a long-term ascites leak afterwards. You're not fixing their overall problem of the cancer. So often these patients are not surgical candidates. And also putting cholecystostomy tubes in these patients can be challenging because they'll likely leak around their cholecystostomy tube. So that really adds another dimension to trying to care for some advanced patients where none of our interventions that are a procedure actually can help the patient. So antibiotics and time may work in patients without cancer, but another unique part of a cancer patient is often they're on chemotherapy or about to start chemotherapy, and the idea of watching and waiting in a cancer patient may not work because they have future episodes of neutropenia coming their way when they're back on chemotherapy. So sometimes operating soon does make sense if the patient has a good performance status and there is a future need for chemotherapy or interrupting their treatment and it's a meaningful treatment. Overall, 20% of patients treated with delayed cholecystectomies, and this is in a general population, do re-present prior to their scheduled OR date for an emergent cholecystectomy. So increase that number if we study that in the patient that has future episodes of neutropenia. So that's why I think if a high-performance performing patient who needs to have a gallbladder out at some point, the idea of watching and waiting with a future need for chemotherapy usually does not work. So calculus cholecystitis would be commonly found in a breast cancer patient with right upper quadrant pain and elevated white count. This would be a woman who fits common demographics for having gallbladder issues. Standard treatments, right upper quadrant ultrasound, cancer staging, performance status evaluation, and then considering lap chole or cholecystostomy tube if they're unfit. Patients can get chemotherapy once a cholecystostomy tube is in. You can have a cholecystostomy tube for years if need be. Once the source control is obtained and the gallbladder is being drained, it's fine to treat the patient on chemotherapy if that's the only way to treat their gallbladder disease. Now, neutropenic patients are a population that can be very challenging to treat, and there's different levels of neutropenia. At the most extreme levels, it's difficult to do any intervention on them. This we see in our bone marrow transplant population, and they're often patients that have acalculus cholecystitis. And it's infrequent, less than 1% in these patients with leukemia or lymphoma. They will usually, by the time you're called, already be on broad-spectrum antibiotics, already be NPO, because usually they've presented with some signs of sepsis. They have neutropenic fever. They have very vague symptoms. They don't have a normal inflammatory response. They won't have a Murphy sign. And the medical team has usually been trying to figure out for a few weeks what's actually happening. So often that's already done by the time you're called in. And this is a challenging patient population with mortality rates from surgery as high as 50%. So often these are the ones with acalculus cholecystitis. And in these patients, there is a better chance of a cholecystostomy tube working and not requiring a cholecystectomy ever, meaning you can get the cholecystostomy tube out without operating on the patient. A unique type of acalculus cholecystitis is chemical cholecystitis, and this we see after our patients who have hepatic arterial embolizations, where there's a reflux of particles up the cystic artery. Now, often we'll actually get a call from our interventional radiologist, and they'll say, we're worried about cholecystitis. We watched it reflux up. There's nothing they can do about it. And so those are patients we keep a closer eye on. It's more common with TACE and Y90 than it is with bland embolization. The bland beads don't seem to have as much of an effect on the gallbladder. And this can be really horrible cholecystitis, gangrenous cholecystitis. Usually in these patients, we do place a cholecystostomy tube because often, once the gallbladder heals from this ischemic insult, we can get the cholecystostomy tube out and you actually do not have to perform a cholecystectomy. So then this third scenario, which is common, duodenal cancer patient 4 weeks after having had a covered metal stent placed in the common bile duct, presents with cholecystitis. So this happens up to 10% of times after patients have common bile duct stents placed, and the thought is that this is covering the cystic duct, but frequently it's because whatever the primary problem is that the stent is placed for has tumor tissue that is near the orifice of the cystic duct, and that's what blocks it. Theoretically, uncovered stents have less of a risk, although we do see cholecystitis in those patients. So there's a couple examples of how these are treated. They don't all have to be treated with cholecystectomy. Sometimes these can be dealt with just by the gastroenterologist. So in someone with a covered metal stent and cholecystitis, it's possible to exchange that for an uncovered metal stent. In someone with pancreas cancer, months into chemotherapy with a covered metal stent and cholecystitis, it's possible also to remove the covered metal stent. They can do that if there's already ingrowth into the stent, even with a covered stent, and they can't get it out. They'll place a stent inside a stent, and that causes ischemia of whatever tissue is growing into that the original stent. Then they can remove them both and replace it with a plastic stent, because a plastic stent shouldn't have any obstruction. Sometimes these maneuvers alone prevent a patient from needing anything else done to their gallbladder. So what happens after you place a cholecystostomy tube? This is some data from our institution. 43 patients, half of them had calculus cholecystitis. 42% of them had a common bile duct stent. Most of those were metal stents. And you can split them into sort of two categories. One is the patients with biliary stents. And in those, 28% had their tube removed. 22% had a cholecystectomy. In the patients with no biliary stent, many more of them had definitive treatment, had either the tube removed or a cholecystectomy. Now, these numbers don't add up to 100 because many patients get a cholecystostomy tube and never get any other procedure, either having it removed or having a cholecystectomy, and live with the tube for the remainder of their life. Some questions to ask with cholecystostomy tube. Is the cystic duct open? If it is, when they flush the cholecystostomy tube, that's the question I want to know from my interventional radiologist. Then you have a better chance of being able to get that tube out without removing the gallbladder. And if there are small stones that are causing a problem, sometimes we'll have them removed percutaneously through the cholecystostomy tube tract with cages, and that also can avoid a cholecystectomy in a patient who's not a good candidate for it. So I'll end with talking about biliary obstruction, and there's intrinsic and extrinsic causes of this. It can be gallstones, tumor, strictures. An extrinsic compression, a common one to think about is lymph nodes. Serious lymphadenopathy can be a major cause of biliary obstruction. Any sort of tumor in the upper abdomen can cause this obstruction. And we do see patients who have autoimmune cholangiopathies, which looks like a cancer, looks and it causes a stenosis, but is actually completely benign. So these can be treated with ERCP, plastic stents. They're great for temporary, a couple months of patency, if someone is going to have a procedure done in the future that will preclude them from needing more drainage. Covered metal stents are removable, so those are good in patients who need long-term drainage, but may have a procedure, say a Whipple in 6 months, which would remove the need for future drainage. And uncovered metal stents are good in a patient who's going to need this permanently. And percutaneous transhepatic cholangiograms through the liver are the other option. So cholangitis is diagnosed, if you remember, from training, Charcot's triad, jaundice, fever, and right upper quadrant pain. And the etiology for this are stones, stenoses, and cancers. You have to, at some point, have gotten contamination of normally sterile bile in order to have cholangitis. The initial treatment is medical, NPO, IV fluids, antibiotics, and analgesia, and then deciding on how is the biliary tree going to be decompressed. And there's really three options, percutaneously from above, ERCP from below, or in the operating room. There are some guidelines if you're interested about cholecystitis and cholangitis, the Tokyo guidelines. These are not specific to cancer patients at all. And they really stratify versus severe versus less severe. In the end, everyone gets an ERCP. The question is timing. So everyone will need biliary drainage. And my final pearls on intrahepatic and hilar biliary obstruction are, these can be from primary or secondary malignancy. prior history of instrumentation, it's really important to figure out. So if someone has had an ERCP done somewhere weeks or months ago, you want to get those films to really understand what lit up in the liver, what bile ducts may be contaminated. If the obstruction is at the hilum or above, we really prefer to have a percutaneous drain placed. If the patient has jaundice but does not have infected bile yet, the radiologist can park the catheter proximal to the ampulla, so then you actually do not have contaminated bile, and patients do much better without an intervention across the ampulla if possible. And when asked which side you want to drain, I think the key is that you drain the functional side of the liver or the side that has been contaminated, and that's again where images from prior procedures are very helpful. So in summary, I think we do often over-treat patients in the last months of their life. There are times when biliary tract emergencies can be a terminal event. And when we've looked back at what happens to our palliative patients that we're treating and when we're placing tubes and drains, many of them are not alive at the first scheduled drain check. And you really have to ask yourself, was that procedure correct? Or would it have been better to treat someone palliatively without an intervention for the remainder of their life? Thank you.